Good morning.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Some signs of life out there on a cold, dreary, dreary morning here in upstate New York. The good thing is that it's hopefully a good sign of spring, right? When you get rain. I really want to thank everybody for joining us again for this morning's Transportation Advisory Panel meeting. We are indeed on a good course here. This is our 12th meeting, and I am so very grateful for your participation and your collaboration with each and every one of these advisory panel meetings, but also all the work that you do on the sub work groups and the interpanel engagements that we've had continuously throughout this process. So again, want to express my sincere thanks to all of you for your collaboration, your participation across the board. We have a very ambitious agenda today, a couple of highlights here. You want to advance the slide? I don't know who's controlling them. There we go. So a couple things. We're going to go through, have a presentation by Cadmus on hydrogen and biofuels. We are also going to be reviewing the preliminary draft of the clean fuels and the market-based work that's been going on in the funding strategies, which I'm sure will engender some good discussion. And we're also going to be taking on, the preliminary strategies, really discussing how these preliminary strategies have been informed, really based on the enormous amount of discussion that we've had at the sub-work group level, as well as a number of experts who have been able to contribute to our discussions on the Transportation Advisory Panel across the board. We've also prepared a brief presentation to address questions that have been raised by you all, by the panel members, on the state's existing electric vehicle programs. And I know we've had a chance to discuss some of these elements. I just want to make sure that we're being, that one, we're being responsive, and two, that we also have a chance to kind of go through all of that information, make sure everybody's, that we're answering questions, et cetera. So, just a couple of quick reminders. If you're not speaking, if you could stay on mute, that would be great. Carolyn, you just want to make sure that we do a quick inventory here of do a roll call for the Transportation Advisory Panel members, please.
Absolutely. Jared Snyder.
Yes, here.
Julie Tai.
Here.
Kareem Talo.
Here.
Abdurillo.
Here.
Corey.
Yes, hi, here.
Steve Finch.
I'm here, thank you.
Nancy Young.
I'm here, thank you.
Demetrius.
Present.
Craig Turner. Paul Allen.
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. John Samuelson. Kendra Hem.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning. LG Holstein.
Here.
Renee Reynolds. Albert Gore.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. It looks like we do have a quorum, Commissioner.
Great, thank you very much. Okay, so as you all know, we've previously heard from the Cadmus group on various strategies regarding the electrification of the transportation sector. as well as how to best, you know, some of the best practices out there in reducing non-productive vehicle trips. So today, it is very much my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jeff Morrison, who will continue to provide some expert research on the role that hydrogen and biofuels can play in decarbonizing the transportation sector. So, Dr. Morrison, we're very glad you can join us this morning and very much appreciate it if you could share some of the information that you have prepared today. We'll go right into it.
Great. Thanks so much. You can go to the next slide. So I'm going to talk about four things today. I'm going to give you a project status of our clean transportation roadmap. I'm going to talk about the state of hydrogen biofuels in New York State. A couple slides on the role of hydrogen biofuels in deep decarbonization, just sort of more broadly. And then finally, some policy insights. You know, it's a pretty sort of vast landscape out there. So I'm not going to talk about everything, and I'm also totally fine if folks want to interrupt and ask a question or provide a comment. Next slide. Just really quick on project status. We are vetting our quantitative results right now with NYSERDA this week and next week. And additionally, we have an outline prepared for our clean transportation roadmap that will be out this spring. So we're starting to sort of put the pieces together. We've written some of the qualitative pieces that go into that roadmap. And once our sort of modeling is complete, we'll also add that more quantitative part of the roadmap and put it all together. So I can't promise anything, but my hope is next time CADMIS is addressing this group, we'll be looking at our mitigation cases and talking a little more in numbers. Next slide. So just a couple quick slides on sort of state of hydrogen biofuels in New York State presently. Next slide. This is just a sort of a set of barriers that are out there on hydrogen biofuels. These are pretty well known and well understood. I will say, you know, biofuels especially is such a sort of complex space. There's a lot of feedstocks and a lot of different production processes. So this is definitely an oversimplification to boil every biofuel down to a simple table like this. But, you know, we're going to use sort of tables like this in our clean transportation roadmap as sort of communication devices with the general reader. So, you know, we have to do that simplification a little bit. You know, in terms of actual barriers, the availability of fuels is definitely a big one. Hydrogen right now, there's no place to refuel hydrogen vehicles in the state. And for biofuels, there are actually, if you go to the next slide, for biofuels, there's a few places to get biofuels. There's 68 E85 stations. There's one E15 station now that New York allows E15. There are just a couple, I think there's five biodiesel stations in the state. There's no place to fuel publicly for renewable diesel. There's no place to fuel renewable natural gas. And again, there's no hydrogen dispensers. And that compares to roughly 5,000 gasoline and diesel stations. So, so that would be kind of first and foremost. Deploying more fuels would mean more infrastructure. So, you know, that's kind of a snapshot. There is some action in hydrogen, a little bit of action in the Northeast in general. New Jersey has a task force they started in 2020 on looking into ramping up hydrogen. Connecticut has been operating hydrogen fuel cell buses for a decade or so. I've been working closely with the state of Massachusetts in the last 2 years, and what I hear there is they're very interested in hydrogen, but they're pretty much solely focused on transportation electrification and EVs at the moment, and they're taking kind of a wait-and-see strategy, waiting for the cost to come down. And I did see a question that came up. I think I'd prefer to kind of push on and we can get to that question a little bit later. So next slide. Okay, so just a couple slides on sort of the strategic thinking about biofuels and hydrogen more generally in terms of deep decarbonization planning. And this is sort of aligned with a lot of other work in other jurisdictions that, that are making deep decarbonization plans. And here I'm really talking about how are we sort of communicating hydrogen biofuels to the general reader in our clean transportation roadmap. What type of conceptual diagrams are we using to convey those thoughts? So next slide. This is a kind of a busy chart, so I apologize, but it comes from ClimateWorks, and I think it's a really helpful framework. So I guess just starting with the notion that some people have is that we need to electrify everything, and don't stop until 100% of end uses are electrified. And this shows kind of a little bit more nuanced thinking on that is like, yes, we're going to electrify as much as we can. So starting with that left-hand column there, there's certain technologies that fall into this sort of scale now. So that means they're cost-effective today, and the grid carbon intensity is such that they make a lot of sense from a greenhouse gas perspective. And, ClimateWorks puts kind of light duty vehicles and buses in that bucket. So in the middle are the scale later. So this would be a situation where either the cost or the grid carbon intensity aren't quite there yet to justify electrifying. But we think that in, next maybe 10 years, it makes a lot of sense to push towards electrification. And then in the third bucket on the right is the hard to electrify sectors. And so there you really need some alternative solution. And the examples from this are, long haul freight, marine, and aviation. And so I think everyone on this call probably understands this, but I just wanted to show this because it's a sort of a helpful conceptual diagram for where hydrogen and biofuels ultimately fit best in the deep decarbonization is that right-hand bucket. Next slide. Another sort of way of thinking about it is in terms of actual vehicle applications and sort of the phasing approach, or what's called the beachhead approach by CalSTART. This is a CalSTART graphic. You start with the sort of easiest and lowest cost applications that you need to use hydrogen biofuels in, and you move to the right, and eventually you get to that fourth wave and are using hydrogen and biofuel on the right hand side. So again, just a conceptual diagram for sort of a communication purposes with our readers. Next slide. The final piece that I think is really important when you're thinking about hydrogen and biofuels, or specifically biofuels, are just vehicle lifetimes and the number of replacements we have out to 2050. So assuming all of these vehicle categories are replaced in 2020, That's how many vehicle replacement cycles you have until 2050. And, you know, of course, with biofuels and some of those vehicle types on the bottom there, we really only have one, maybe two replacement cycles before we get to 2050. So in a large way, we're stuck with those vehicles, and our options are to use a drop-in fuel once those are out on the road, or we could try for some early vehicle retirement program, like a cash for clunkers. But, you know, that has not been tried before, to my knowledge, for ferries and aircraft. You know, that's what we're going to be stuck with, that vehicle stock pretty soon. So that's just a couple kind of quick thoughts on sort of where hydrogen biofuels kind of fit with our whole deep decarbonization. You can go to the next slide. Now I'm just going to talk about some sort of policy insights. You can go to the next slide. There are really a lot of different policies that we could be exploring, and we've worked with NYSERDA to kind of narrow these down into just a couple broad policy categories. So if you advance one time here, you'll see. So there's four policy categories that we were asked to go into more depth on. One would be incentives for distribution and fueling infrastructure. Two is low carbon fuel standard. And three are vehicle mandates. And so we're including the Advanced Clean Cars 2 and Advanced Clean Trucks rule. And again, we're looking at these policies right now just through the lens of hydrogen and biofuels. And so we're kind of pushing the EVs to the side right now. You know, our analysis is looking at three dimensions of these fuels. So effectiveness first, meaning how effective are they in actually spurring adoption of the fuels. And we split out biofuels and hydrogen. And low means it's not very effective. Medium is somewhat effective. High means it's very effective at advancing these fuels. The second dimension, if you advance one more time, is economics and finance. And again, so this is a dimension of just how much is the sort of cost burden when we're putting these fuels into place. And again, this is definitely a simplification. There's a lot more nuance we're going to be discussing in the roadmap than shown here. Third dimension, if you advance one more time, is equity and public health. And here it ranges from little benefit to large benefit. So that's the broad kind of four categories of policies we're looking at in the dimensions. Now, I can't go through kind of each one of these boxes in this PowerPoint slide, but we will be kind of exploring those in the Clean Transportation Roadmap. Look forward to that. So I'm just going to kind of highlight a few things that I think this group might find interesting from this kind of three dimensions by four policies matrix. So if you go to the next slide. This is a very busy slide, so I apologize for that. This is a graphic that the California Air Resources Board puts every year, and they do a status of the hydrogen industry in California. That has a lot of really rich information about how hydrogen fuel cells are advancing in the market, and specifically the role that some of the policies are playing in spurring that advancement. And I guess the thing to really look at is the red triangles on the bottom are the number of fuel cell electric vehicles. So it's gone from 6,000 in 2019 to 7,000 today. It's pretty flat growth rate right now. There's there's some questions about fuel availability. They have stations in California. They have 45 stations, mostly in Southern California, but some in Northern California too, that are have supply issues with their hydrogen sometimes. So sometimes they'll be closed and sometimes they'll be open. That's hurting things. And the cost of the vehicles has stayed pretty much where it's been for the last few years. Those big blue and orange bands there that you see are basically the auto industry projecting how many fuel cell electric vehicles will be out on the road. So some of those projections actually were made a few years ago, but were put on this graph. And I won't go into the difference between the band, but they're basically OEM projections. And the point here is that kind of every year the auto industry is projecting the number of vehicles. Every year the actual number of registrations falls short of those projections. And I guess just in general, I'm trying to take a really balanced approach when talking about hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, but they're the fact is that they haven't been just taking off in the same way that electric vehicles did in 2011, 2012. And so the growth rate is just a little bit more stagnant than electric vehicles. A quick correction. I said 45 stations. There's actually 48 stations right now in California. They're moving towards 200 stations. So that's the two policies that the California Air Resources Board says that are really advancing the fuel cell vehicles are the provision in the low carbon fuel standard that that provides basically money to the refueling stations, special credits designed to incentivize hydrogen stations. And then the second thing is just the grant program run by the Energy Commission that provides money for to the stations themselves. So those two are the primary policies advancing fuel cells. Okay, so that's a little bit about hydrogen. I know I didn't give it too much justice. You can go to the next slide. Mentioned low carbon fuel standard. I know this group has been talking about the LCFS a lot. These are two graphs showing kind of the growth in total fuel volume in California and in Oregon on the bottom from year one, year four, and then year nine in the California program. Basically, the fuel mix in the entire state. And I'm not trying to say anything is causal here, but there are some general conclusions or insights you can see specifically around that those green wedges. If you look, which is the biomass based diesel wedge, so that's biodiesel and renewable diesel kind of together. And in the California program in year one of the LCFS, they had very little. Biomass-based diesel is less than 1%. By year four, it was 1%, and then by year nine, it was approximately 25% of the entire diesel pool. So a pretty fast growth in biomass-based diesel. In Oregon, in year one, they started with more than California did in terms of the biomass-based diesel, but it also grew in year four. So I think that aligns with what this group has talked about in terms of LCFS, kind of one of the first sort of expected outcomes would be an increase in the biomass-based diesel. So I also understand there's a lot of questions about the greenhouse gas accounting system that would be used in the low carbon fuel standard in New York, if there is one, and so that's happy to provide my own thoughts on that. But But this is what we've observed, I guess, historically in California and Oregon. So is there for our own insights. Okay. I'm jumping around a lot here, but the next slide, I only have two more slides. Go to the next slide, please. The next slide is just thinking about equity and low carbon fuel standard. And one of the nice things about a low carbon fuel standard is there are a lot of, it's a really flexible program. So there's a lot of different ways you could incentivize certain outcomes, and equity could be an outcome that you're incentivizing. The two thoughts there on design on the right hand side, you could pair greenhouse gas programs with targeting co-pollutants at the same time as a carbon intensity of the fuel to sort of minimize local impacts of fuel combustion. And then LCFS, one of the greatest benefits is just the revenue generation that you get from it. So the second idea there is you could really focus the investment from that from those LCFS credits on disadvantaged communities, and that would be a way to address equity in the LCFS. Okay, last slide. Again, jumping around, but I think it's something that's been brought up at this group a couple times, and that's just talking about tailpipe emissions of biofuels and sort of health impacts in general. And there may be others who have other insights here to add, but in general, the sort of takeaways from the literature that we've looked at, for biodiesel, most studies show lower emissions across all blends of biofuels except for NOx, and as the blend level of biodiesel goes up, that NOx impact gets greater and greater. So B99 blend would be much higher NOx than a B20 blend. Renewable diesel, the studies are fairly mixed here as well. Some of them say kind of all pollutants are being reduced through use of renewable diesel. There are about a third of the studies show that there are some NOx increases with renewable diesel. So again, it's somewhat inconclusive. And then renewable natural gas, the emissions are really very similar to compressed natural gas. So they generally outperform diesel, but very similar to compressed natural gas. The graphic on the left there, I included in this slide. It's way too busy to talk all the way through, but it's really well aligned with those three bullets, and is a fairly recent study where they looked at different blends of both biodiesel and renewable diesel and compared them to diesel. And you can see basically each of those four levels of bars are different pollutants that they're tracking the difference between. So that's a pretty good study that seems to be kind of in the center of where a lot of the literature is. Okay, so that was a lot of information, and I will stop there and happy to discuss or take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jeff. I know we've got a couple of questions already, but one thing that we did receive a question on, and Renee, I'm happy if you want to address this directly, a question with regard to, literally the impacts regarding biofuels. The concerns. Renee, are you on the line? Yes, I'm on the line. So I just dropped a link to a report that recently came out from the New York Renews Coalition, which really looks at framing these various biofuels as false solutions. And I thought it was interesting, one of the points that's made in the report, based on like one of the conversations that we're having in the subcommittees around sequestration and the ways that these fuels can be renewable. But this report kind of points to, or at least one of the points that I pulled from the report for the purposes of this conversation, was the time frame that it takes for those biofuel emissions to be reabsorbed by regrowth. So I kind of wanted to flag that among a myriad of other concerns around biofuels. So I didn't know if you had any comments related to that.
I don't have anything specific. I guess I haven't seen this report. I just pulled it up, but I guess the timing issue, yeah, it gets complicated quickly. I'd have to kind of gather my thoughts on that and get back to you on thoughts on that.
Well, I think partly doesn't it depend on the feedstock, right? It depends on what feedstocks you're using. I mean, some of these, right? Like some of these fuels are predominantly from wastes, and some of them are from, you know, from growth crops. I think that's really a question about what happens on that from that perspective with the sequestration versus tailpipe, right? So if you're reducing the emissions from landfills, from wastewater treatment plants, from, you know, by using waste oils as they do for, I always forget if it's biodiesel or I think it's renewable diesel.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it depends from that perspective. Similarly, you'd be collecting, you know, things from farms, and other wastewater treatment plants, things like that. I think that varies.
Something important to note about the New York Renews False Solutions Technical Report, quote unquote technical, is that it has not been peer reviewed for its technical content. And so, you know, any of the technical claims that are made within it should be reviewed, right? And either taken with a grain of salt or at least confirmed independently.
Okay. So Dr. Morrison, along those lines, is that, so obviously this has been, the report's been provided here, and obviously Demetrius is looking for, has also stated kind of, you know, it's a new report, peer review. It looks like this just came out. But obviously there's some more here. So if you could take a look at it, I think everybody would appreciate it.
There was a slide that you had that talked about sort of cost impacts. Like you had three different you know, high, medium, low sectors. I don't know if there's like a few slides back. That one. Yeah. So on your economics and finance, can you just describe again what the dollar signs are supposed to represent there?
Yeah, and sorry, just didn't have quite enough time, but it's basically the expense expected to the state of New York to pursue one of these policies. And again, I think you could probably argue some of these. So I'm happy to explain anyone in there if you want.
Well, I just think I'm thinking about low carbon fuel standard, as you point out, it actually injects a lot of funds. I mean, it's within sort of the transportation sector, but it injects a lot to move off of, you know, not just for biofuels and hydrogen. I know we didn't talk about EVs as part of this, but it is, you know, a way to inject funds into moving off of fossil fuels.
Right. So, I mean, maybe you could have a negative dollar sign there. I was thinking in terms of sort of staffing at the state level. You know, California Air Resources Board has about, I think, eight people who are kind of full-time in their LCFS office. And I'm sure there's different ways New York could set it up. But I totally agree. I think, I mean, everyone who talks about LCFS in California always sort of emphasizes that revenue generation. It gives so much flexibility in terms of choices you can make with those funds. That's a good point.
So I just want to be clear. What you're saying, though, is that the dollar signs invest. This is the. Can you just describe what you mean by the dollar signs? I just want to be clear. It's not people per se. It's total cost.
It's cost of the state, and the scale here. I should have included the scale. Scale is either $1 sign, $2 signs, or three. So it's the lowest sort of cost of that's possible in that scale.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from the panel members? For Dr. Morrison.
So in California and in anywhere, right, the amount of electric use right now in this sector is less than 1%. Like you have that chipped up.
Right. Yes. In year nine, I'd have to double check what year nine was. And if you can advance to slide 14. Yeah, that one.
Or it's around 1%.
Right.
Okay. Long way to go for all of us here on that side.
Yeah. And I think a really important point I didn't make with this is that as California was progressing through its LCFS and as Oregon was progressing through its LCFS, you know, the electric vehicles were at a very different stage than they would be at, if New York started one program, say, next year or the year after. And in terms of, you know, the carbon intensity reductions you're getting from those electric vehicle credits could change the calculus a little bit and would mean that New York's progression may not be the same as California or Oregon. And there's a lot of ways to kind of deal with that. If your goal is to increase the biomass-based diesel, you could sort of weight the credits, and there's a lot of ways to deal with that.
Hey, Jeff, this is Albert. A quick question. Was there an estimate of when the industry thinks there will be a 500-mile range hydrogen truck for under $300,000 available, which is one of the thresholds that they look at?
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I can go back and check and get back to you on that.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from the panel members? Okay. Dr. Morrison, thank you very much. We greatly appreciate it. I greatly appreciate the insights, obviously making progress on the study writ large. But we've got a let's move on to our next agenda item here, if we could. So if we could go to next slide, please. So we want to spend the next bit of time here reviewing the sub-work group advisory panel recommendations. So as you all know, over the past few meetings, The sub-work groups have been presenting preliminary recommendations and strategies for the panel's review and consideration, and we've gone through them, I think, well, and had a lot of good back and forth. We've taken on electrification, public transportation, and smart growth. And today, Jared Snyder and Adam Reuter and Ron Epstein are going to be providing the recommendations and strategies that pertain to the clean fuel standards, as well as market-based policies and other funding and finance strategies. And we will discuss some of the things that they're putting, that, well, the work groups are putting on the table as a result of those discussions. So in addition to these presentations, we've also heard in prior presentations, much like we heard this morning, from, you know, other experts as well. So the one thing that I would ask is that we look at all of these as panel members, take this all in, we'll ask questions, we'll have a discussion. But at the end of all of this, if you all could really, we're going to be providing these, look at the recommendations and the strategies in advance and comment in advance of our April 9th meeting, because we're pulling all of these together and hope that, you know, one, this is an opportunity to review these last three buckets. But two, we'll give these to you. You'll have a chance to review them outside of this forum and provide any additional comments back to us so that on our April 9th meeting, we will then have a chance to kind of look at everything holistically and go through any final recommendations that the panel wants to put forward. So with that, I will turn it over to Jared, Adam, and Ron, and we'll start with Jared.
All right, thank you. Commissioner, let's go to the next slide, please. So we're going to be going through a number of potential recommendations from the subgroups for consideration by the full panel. These proposed recommendations will support the transition to clean transportation. Some of these policies directly reduce emissions, you know, while others are probably better seen as enabling policies. They enable reductions to be achieved by financing some of the other strategies we've talked about in previous meetings. So those are transit strategies, electrification strategies, or the like. So today we're going to focus primarily on the first three you see on this list. The fourth, just a second, please. The fourth fee-based we talked about, we discussed at the prior electrification meeting with the electrification recommendations. And then the last five, Ron will touch on. They're all, you know, somewhat less developed. So you know, I think we'd be interested in your feedback, which ones we should develop further for consideration by the panel. We're going to run through all of these first, and then we'll have questions and dialogue after that. So next slide, please. So following up on the presentation we just saw, you know, this potential recommendation is to develop a clean fuel standard. Now, a clean fuel standard is a mechanism that places the burden on the petroleum industry of financing the transition to clean energy sources for transportation. It supports electrification. It also supports, you know, near-term emission reductions from substituting biofuels, cleaner biofuels, for petroleum fuels. And those cleaner fuels can also, you know, help to you know, decarbonize some of the hard-to-electrify sources. I want to make, you know, there's a lot of information on this slide. I just want to emphasize really three points. One is sometimes there's a misconception that a clean fuel standard or a low carbon fuel standard is a policy to support just biofuels. And that's not, or biofuels instead of electrification. And that's not the case. You know, a clean fuel standard also supports electrification, that providers of electrification earn credits under a clean fuel standard, and then that the value of those credits can then be reinvested in more electrification. And that's, you know, been realized in California, which has had a clean fuel standard for a number of years. You know, a second point is our electrification strategies are intended to electrify our transportation as quickly as possible. And, you know, we're talking about ambitious schedules of requiring 100% electric vehicles sales, you know, sometime in the next decade. Even if we achieve that, there's still going to be a lot of petroleum fuels used in the interim. And so the goal, you know, a partial goal of a clean fuel standard is to enable cleaner fuels to be used in place of those petroleum fuels in the interim as we're moving to electrification, recognizing that the end goal is electrification to the greatest degree possible and as quickly as possible. So another thing, you know, that I want to mention is cost issues. There's, you know, some concern that, you know, a clean fuel standard would increase the price of petroleum fuels, you know, particularly for low-income consumers that are maybe less available to afford electric vehicles. You know, the evidence is somewhat mixed about the price impact of clean fuel standard in California and Oregon, two places that have it already, that is hard to discern, you know, that price impact in the various trends that you see in the price of fuels. But you know, it, you know, even if there is a impact on the fuel price, and, you know, you would assume there probably would be some impact on the fuel price from a clean fuel standard, that complementary strategies, you know, that we've discussed previously in electrification will target getting lower income consumers into electric vehicles, providing increased incentives for electric vehicles so that, you know, everyone can take advantage of it. So, you know, we're conscious of you know, the need to ensure equity in the implementation of any program, whether it's the clean fuel standard or any other. And then a third point I want to raise is the accounting for emission reductions, that the clean fuel standard as done in California and Oregon takes a life cycle approach, looks at the life cycle emissions from all fuels. The accounting, you know, so that's from the production of the fuels. It looks at the benefits of reducing waste emissions for waste-based fuels. That all goes into the calculation of the carbon intensity. That doesn't align perfectly with the way we account for emissions in meeting our emission limits in New York State under the CLCPA. You know, for example, the CLCPA requires us to consider upstream emissions from petroleum fuels in meeting those limits, but not upstream emissions or upstream emission reductions from the production of biofuels. So, you know, that's going to be a question that we're going to have to face if we proceed with a clean fuel standard in designing it, is how do we take account of some of those differences? And, you know, as people pointed out in California, it's sort of the same issue exists. They're accounting for emission reductions in meeting their, you know, statewide limits is not the same methodology they apply in determining the carbon intensity of fuels under their clean fuel standard. So next slide, please. Developing and implementing a clean fuel standard would be a fairly time-consuming process. You know, what we have it predict here is estimate approximately 2 years for that process. I also want to point out just one thing. The bottom entry on this slide is, there may be value in complementary investments in green hydrogen infrastructure. And, you know, green hydrogen is hydrogen that's created from water through an electrolysis process powered by renewable energy. So it produces zero carbon fuel source that can, you know, play a role, particularly in long distance trucking. But a clean fuel standard would not stimulate that development by itself. So there may be a need for some complementary programs to stimulate the development of that infrastructure. Next slide, please. So I think I touched on some of this, but on impacts on disadvantaged communities and health benefits. Obviously, there's a substantial reduction in emissions from electrification, some of which would be, helped along by a clean fuel standard. In the short term, there's also reductions in some pollutants, as Dr. Morrison's presentation showed, reduction in particulate matter, at least, from the substitution of diesel replacements for diesel. And, you know, diesel has pretty significant local emission impact. So that's, you know, a public health benefit and a benefit that would be realized in disadvantaged communities where there is a heavy burden of diesel traffic. And just transition, a clean fuel standard would have really, little just transition impact because, for the most part, the same, fueling sources would be used for fueling vehicles. It'd just be, substituting renewable diesel, biodiesel for diesel at the pump. One benefit, from an economic perspective is the potential creation of businesses to produce renewable fuels in New York. We don't produce any petroleum fuels in New York. So, we would not be putting any petroleum, people in the refinery industry out of work in New York in this policy, but we could be creating jobs with, new opportunities for producing biofuels. And then one final point I'll make here is, I mentioned the way electrification generates credits. Another significant credit generator would be, if we follow the California model, would be electrified transit generates credits. So that would provide, an infusion of resources to MTA and other transit agencies to support and enhance their systems. So that, I think that's, enough of a summary here. Why don't I turn it over now to Adam to talk about some financing strategies to, complement, public funding with, ways of leveraging that funding with private money. So I'll turn it over to you, Adam.
Thanks, Jared, and thank you to the entire panel and Commissioner Dominguez for having me today. Can we go to the next slide, please? Great. So there's been a lot of work going on in the private sector and with folks like New York Green Bank, who has been helpful advisors on this topic as well, around how we can get more private sector investment and financing in into the market around, especially around electrification and ways to really reduce the amount that fleets need to put out of pocket for the upfront cost of their of these new vehicles, which can be quite a bit higher than the cost, upfront cost of a diesel truck. So there are a number of different approaches that have been taken both in this market and learning from other parts of the clean energy space and the private financing space in general. And a number of challenges that have arisen that we are looking to resolve through these types of programs. We see most of these actions as financial in nature and through state agency investments and partnerships that augment other financing and EV charging investments. This is a on the dollar scale, this is a kind of medium investment. There will be some need for outlaying money both from existing programs, but also potentially some additional programs, as well as some support to get the financing going and reduce risk up front to really get the market moving, plus some additional analysis, which is relatively low cost to support this. We think that this is a medium ease of implementation. There will need to be some new programs established, but they are based on proven models. And as I noted, there are examples of this type of financing in other markets that we're really looking to bring to the clean transportation space, as well as some recent examples from Maryland and in particular of significant private financing for school bus electrification. As I noted, there are some challenges, and one will be figuring out exactly what the right structure is for establishing this type of financing program, which is focused on first loss protection. I'll get into that a little bit more in a moment. But we think that that's an addressable challenge. We have noted that the current level of incentives and qualifications around the New York Truck Voucher incentive program and other incentive type programs in New York State can be difficult to navigate for certain fleets, especially smaller trucking fleets and lower income truck owners. And there is a need to find additional money that can supplement what we've already got and help to expand the programs to those types of fleets. We know that there are some challenges around particularly public fleets transitioning to this type of model of using private sector financing. That's not typically how they've operated, and there will need to be some flexibility and some support to those fleets to help them understand how to take advantage of these types of programs. And then, you know, there's another challenge of just trying to figure out the right fit to help help these projects move forward and make sure that New York Green Bank is able to participate and offer appropriate and attractive terms for these projects. Next slide. So what this looks like is one of the biggest challenges for getting commercial financing of electric truck and bus purchases is the lack of understanding of what the residual value might be at the end of the financing term. So if a institution is going to offer financing for, say, 5 years, they need to be able to understand what the residual value of that truck or bus is going to be after 5 years. And because these vehicles are so new to the market, there really isn't much established established understanding of what that looks like. That means, number one, there's a large amount of risk around around any value that is established. And number two, it means that that commercial lending institutions just simply can't offer these terms based on the regulations that they're subject to for making sound investments without further information. So the way that this type of program would work would be to understand what has to happen. First, understand what has to happen to develop a program that can reduce the risk associated with offering commercial lending for electric trucks based on the unknown residual value. Identify who in New York State can work with the private sector to develop this product, and how much of a subsidy or risk premium would need to be offered to make this a viable product. We would also need to conduct some residual value risk analysis to appropriately price this product, and secure private market practitioner involvement to say yes, if this risk were reduced by, you know, in this way, then we would be willing to lend. So there's a lot of partnerships needed, a lot of additional analysis and research needed. But if this can happen, if we get these pieces in place, we can really unlock some of the commercial lending institutions to participate in financing electric trucks and buses. And given the understanding that electric trucks and buses tend to be less expensive to maintain and in many cases less expensive to operate, although not all cases as of yet, we think that there's a really good argument to be made that this financing can really help get this market moving. In addition to that, we think there is a need for expanded incentive programs, specifically for some of the types of fleets that are going to have a tougher time taking advantage of financing options. So, fleets that don't have the credit record that a typical commercial bank might be looking for in their lending. So smaller fleets, some fleets in disadvantaged communities that may not have that type of credit record. This is something that we think goes well with the First Loss Protection Program, and can help to reinforce each other. Next slide, please. Additionally, we think that a program to offer feasibility studies for fleets that goes above and beyond potentially what the utilities are offering. They recently were allowed to start offering fleet assessment services to fleets, but there may be some additional feasibility studies and technical assistance that fleets might be looking for. Offering these types of services to fleets can really help them get to the point where they can make these types of decisions to move forward with these purchases. And similarly, we think that expanding the additional financing options for charging stations can also help the process and speed up the decision making to say yes. We're ready to, the fleet's ready to move forward with this, including, providing some more flexibility for the New York Green Bank to focus on this and potentially take on some additional risks in specific categories around electrification, and supplementing the capital financial support for charging stations, which tends to come through the utility programs and NYSERDA's rebate programs, with some potential revenue support for qualifying EV charging station projects. Next slide. We think that this could potentially have some pretty significant impacts in disadvantaged communities, making it much more feasible for fleets that are operating in these communities to electrify their vehicles, and not having to wait for significant new infusions of incentive money, and moving forward with private sector financing. You know, similarly, diesel trucks are a major source of air pollution in New York State, and especially in disadvantaged communities. And we do think that this type of program could have significant health and other related benefits. And we do think that it will bring economic, employment, and health benefits to these communities through helping, specifically helping these businesses to move to these cleaner vehicles and move forward with new technologies. So you know, I think that's a few of these things have been touched on in the electrification slides, so in electrification recommendations, but there's definitely, and in the public transportation slides, but these are mutually reinforcing with the other recommendations. And that's it for electrification financing. Jared, back to you.
Sure, right. Thank you, Adam. And let's go to the next slide. So in addition to exploring the financing measures that Adam discussed, the subgroup has recognized the need for some public funding to support other strategies. You know, most importantly, electrification and enhancement of transit. Particularly in disadvantaged communities, for both areas. So the proposed recommendation here, after a fair amount of discussion, is to recommend participation in the regional transportation and climate initiative Cap and Invest program, unless the Climate Action Council settles on a different approach for funding all the strategies that we need to decarbonize New York's economy. So for those unfamiliar with Transportation Climate Initiative, which I'll refer to as TCI, it's a program that was developed by roughly a dozen states over the last couple of years, that would cap and reduce emissions from petroleum fuels. Over a decade, that cap would decline 30% from the starting point. So, you know, you would get, approximately a 30% reduction in emissions from vehicles that are powered by petroleum fuels. The mechanism it uses to do that is through an allowance system. It would auction emission allowances to the petroleum industry. They would have to pay for these allowances to cover the emissions from the fuels they sell. And then proceeds from those auctions would be used to invest in clean transportation. Really, to invest in all these other strategies that we've been talking about. Incentives for electric trucks, incentives for electric vehicles, enhanced transit, maybe smart growth strategies. And the group of states has committed to invest at least 35% of the proceeds in disadvantaged communities, and to do that through engagement with the communities. So far, three states have committed to implement this as three New England states. A number of others are still considering whether to do so, including New York. And, you know, the feeling of you know, this subgroup was that, you know, this panel should consider a recommendation that New York join those states that would be implementing TCI. Now, I want to emphasize that TCI is not in place of other strategies. Sometimes there's a misunderstanding about, you know, cap and invest programs that we would just rely on market forces to achieve emission reductions. Well, you know, that think of it more as a cap and invest approach, as an enabling strategy to fund all those other strategies that have been identified. So, you know, how do you fund the electrification? How do you fund the transit enhancement? And that's the role that something like TCI would play, in addition to the price effect as having some impact itself. And you're, you know, getting that guarantee of 30% reduction in emissions from petroleum fuels. So let me just touch on a couple of these risks that we mentioned at the bottom here. You know, one concern we've heard is a potential for funds to be used for unrelated purposes. A potential solution to that would be some kind of lockbox that ensures that, you know, the funding is used for the purposes, you know, identified for the policy, supporting clean transportation or any other purposes identified. Another concern is that you know, there is some significant opposition from some members of the environmental justice communities. And, you know, that's based in distrust of market-based programs, based on the early experience, at least with the California cap and trade program. And, you know, a solution to that is ensuring that investments are made for the benefit of disadvantaged communities with the participation of disadvantaged communities. So, you know, that's, and another slide gets into this a little bit more. A third concern is that even that 30% reduction may not be enough to achieve our transportation goals. And, you know, this is not the only policy, obviously, that we're considering. And then there's also an opportunity to strengthen the cap as, you know, over the course of implementing it. You know, we've implemented a similar program, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative for the power sector. And twice the states have got together, realized we're making better progress than we thought, and strengthened the cap to achieve even greater emission reductions. So the same process would be anticipated if we were to join the TCI program. So next slide. The process to implement it is fairly simple. The states, particularly the three states that have committed to develop the program, have developed a model regulation to implement. You know, they're going to have that regulation in place by the end of this year. We could, you know, whenever a decision was made to participate in TCI, we could also adopt that a model rule with any adjustments we'd want to make for New York. And that would not be that time consuming or burdensome a process. Next slide, please. So, yes, touching on the benefits and impacts of the program. You know, we recognize that a market-based policy does not necessarily achieve emission reductions in specific locations, including disadvantaged communities. That, however, can be a role for the investments. And, you know, the members of the subgroup that discussed this really talked about the highest and best use of the proceeds would be to invest more than that minimum of 35 to 40% required by the CLCPA, but even more of that in programs that reduce emissions and provide benefits in disadvantaged communities. And part of that is because, the emission reductions that we see have greater public health benefits in those communities where a lot of people live. And so to the extent you're reducing pollution, you're providing more ample public health benefits. On the health and co-benefits side, the Harvard School of Public Health did an analysis for TCI that projected a number of favorable public health incomes, reduced mortality, reduced illness, in general, healthier people as a result of a program like this. But, again, that's driven largely by the investment strategies. Investment of proceeds can also be used to support just transition, to support some of the workforce development programs we've discussed in prior meetings. So there is going to be a transition from petroleum to these other sources. And, again, a program like this that raises proceeds can help manage that transition. And, I guess a final point, that I wanted to make is, we've heard from at least one of the members of the subgroup that it's important to also maintain funding for maintaining sort of the current system. So don't think just about investing in new clean transportation, but we need to maintain the existing transit systems, the existing road systems, that we should not allow something like this TCI mechanism to interfere with that, and maybe consider some of those efforts, like maintaining transit systems, to be an appropriate use of the proceeds. So let me turn it over now to Ron to talk about some of the other funding mechanisms that we talked about, that some of which get at that last point, I think.
Thanks, Jared. Can you hear me?
Hello? Hear you. Yeah, we hear you, Ron.
Okay, great. Next slide, please.
We don't see you, though, Ron, just the top of your head.
Oh, that's my best feature. Can you hear me and see me now? So let's actually skip to the next slide, since we're going to cover all this information on the next slide as well. So basically, as Jared mentioned, that TCI is the only strategy whereby we might be able to raise additional revenues that can be used to support green initiatives and sustain services that are being, currently credited to the GHG reductions that occur, at the current moment. So a couple of those strategies deal with pricing. There's congestion pricing, which is not just a downstate metropolitan issue. There's variable pricing, which could be a form of congestion pricing, where you have a cordon that you are basically tolling and setting tolls based on time of day and the amount of congestion within that area, or a strictly time, day versus night. And a lot of times you'll see variable pricing used for trucks to try and get trucks to do a nighttime delivery. And then there's demand parking. And what that's basically doing is it is pricing the curb. And so if you want to park nearby to a specific location, that may actually have a very different cost structure associated with parking further away in less congested areas of a particular area. All of these would require close coordination and cooperation between the state, municipalities, and potentially require a statute. They are the kinds of things that can be done without a lot of infrastructure investment, in terms of, recalibrating parking meters or setting up zones, perhaps putting up some easy pass transponders to read vehicles and assign charges appropriately. But the big issue is that, setting up the protocols for when and how these might be applied. They also allow for, making adjustments for low-income individuals, whereby whether it be a credit, a rebate, or some other structure. Give you an example, in the congestion pricing proposal that is pending for the New York City area, individuals that earn up to $60,000 a year would actually get rebates for, the pricing that they may incur for traveling into the Central Business District. Another option for raising revenues could be increasing the vehicle registration fees, and that could be based on the type of vehicle. You could do it based on internal combustion. You could do it based on the value of vehicles. Maybe it's SUVs compared to smaller vehicles. There's a lot of leeway in terms of how a state could choose to increase vehicle registration fees. One note of interest here in New York, we can get you some data, but is among the lowest in the nation in terms of the amount of charges for its vehicle registration fees. This again would require legislation. And again, we're mindful of the need for potential discounts for individuals that may be low income. One of the most popular, issue, or I should say fees, or alternative revenue sources to the gas tax that's been discussed for decades, literally, and there are several pilots in play right now, is people refer to it as either vehicle mile travels tax, or it's really a miles-based user fees. And you're basically paying on the virtue of how much you drive. And basically, you would get a bill. Your car would have a reader, and you would get billed on how much you utilize the infrastructure that needs to be maintained, or the privilege of traveling along these particular segments. In certain areas, we've done this in New York before, either creating special assessment districts, which is where you actually pay up front towards a project, or tax increment financing, which is you're using the increased tax values around the project to pay down debt issued on behalf. These are typically used for public transportation projects. They do require special authorization and involves the participation of developers and affected businesses. And lastly, there's curb pricing, which is very similar to demand parking. But curb pricing is essentially where you're targeting a specific type of vehicle. It might be that if you're a clean fuel vehicle, zero emission vehicle, there would be no fee for parking in a certain designated zone. And then the more emissions that you have, the fee would go up exponentially. The difference between, the suite of potential opportunities here and something like TCI is TCI is something that people will pay at the pump. And so you might see an increase of a few cents per gallon as a result of that. That may or may not influence the way you travel or orient you towards alternative means such as public transportation or maybe it's transportation network corporations. These all actually factor in choice. So if you're choosing to go into a particular area and you want to see a movie or a baseball game or whatever, you may actually consciously think about, do I want to pay the cordon fee, or do I want to pay the demand parking fee in addition to the tickets, the restaurant, whatever else you might be doing? So these are more what I'll call conscious type activities that are intended to influence behavior and travel, means. So that is kind of the big difference between TCI. They're all complementary. They all have their pluses and their minuses in terms of how one may actually decide to travel. But the one thing it does, the one thing all of these do is they create the opportunity to generate revenue to not only renew the infrastructure, but to renew it in the greenest possible way. Certainly, we would be mindful of, we don't want to drive up housing costs, which may disadvantage certain communities, because especially when you talk about tax increment financing or a special assessment district. But basically what you're doing is you're assuming there's going to be a lot of growth as a result of that activity. That typically means that housing prices and retail square footage prices increase. So we want to make sure that we take steps to ensure that we're not pricing people out of the communities that they live in. Certainly, the other aspect of these is they're all trying to deal with declines in peak hour pollution, which is, you know, something that, maybe, you know, additional few cents on the gas tax may not accomplish. But it's the combination of these that, you know, hopefully will reduce when people travel or provide them with the alternatives that they need to travel. And the last part of this is that they're all intended to support economic opportunities for communities that may not currently exist. And some of them, you know, bring about workforce opportunities. Obviously, there would need to be, training and technical assistance in terms of the just transition. But certainly what we're trying to do here is, you know, provide opportunities for people to maintain the existing infrastructure. At the same time, we're transitioning to these new technologies, which the new technologies would be required for implementing things such as mileage-based user fees, as well as, you know, variable pricing. So with that, let me stop and I guess turn it back over to the commissioner.
So, Ron, I just want to make sure you talked to, you had one more slide here, and I think you talked to the elements.
Elements in them are right. We could skip that slide, but that basically gets to the job creation, the housing issues, the opportunity. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure because the slide didn't advance.
I know.
So if we could advance the slide one, that would be great. Thank you. So you talked to these areas, but I just wanted to make sure that people saw they were captured here.
Thank you.
Okay. So Ron, before you you take us off camera here, I just want to make sure we have a chance to open it up for discussion a little bit. I think the bottom line here is that, you know, we're looking at all of these various market-based strategies and financing policies. While TCI is a potential solution, there's other things that are certainly on the table here, as has been articulated. So do we have any additional questions from the panel members at this time with regard to the materials that Jared and Adam and Ron have put forward? Everybody's good?
Sounds like we have complete concurrence.
All right.
Actually, this is Paul. I have I'd call it like a procedural question. Commissioner, at the beginning, you mentioned that you wanted to be sure that the panel had an opportunity to see these materials, discuss them, ask questions, and then provide any additional thoughts or feedback before the April 9th meeting.
Correct.
I
realize that this is a lot to take in right now, so I'm not expecting a lot of questions. My point being, thank you, Paul, if that's what you're going, that you, this is a lot to take in right now, you will have opportunity to further comment, but I apologize if you had another question.
No, that's what I wanted to clarify, that we weren't saying, blessing these words, final, done, off they go.
No.
Okay, good. Thank you.
No blessing required right now. Just wanted to make sure that we had a robust presentation, which I think we did on all of these materials, and time for you all to consider them. And, obviously the sub work groups have been working on a number of these, but full visibility of the panel is what we're looking for.
So, Commissioner Dominguez, I'd just like to say, in addition to questions, if any of the subpanel members want to offer any of their own, insights to complement what Ron, Adam, and I presented, I would, say now's a good time to do that.
So, I guess I do have a thought, as long as I have my camera on and my microphone open. First of all, thank you to everyone who's pull these together. It's not easy, and it's hard to fit sometimes complicated, multifaceted ideas into these kinds of templates, but it's necessary to do it. I understand that. I think it's also helpful for all of us to remember that, you know, previously we've talked about setting standards, such as the California Advanced Clean Truck Standard for medium and heavy duty vehicles, and sales of zero emission vehicles, EVs or other zero emission vehicles by, you know, a date pretty soon, and, you know, maybe 10 or 12 years out from now. And that suggests to me that this kind of portfolio of what I see as very complementary, in the sense that they mutually reinforce each other, these financing and market-based policies are vital to being ready to have the owners and operators, whether they're private passenger cars or fleets of commercial vehicles, for them to be well ready to meet those new standards when they begin to really take hold in an orderly way. So, and I guess I'll say something about one of them, the Transportation Climate Initiative and the Cap and Invest. It would generate around $300 to $350 million a year in the first year of operation, and then it would do so year after year, and that money could become available as soon as toward the end of 2023. And so it's valuable both in its own right, because the state is going to need money to help incentivize the changes that would have to take place. It needs funds to address urgent problems in overburdened places. But it also needs some, the money is valuable because it comes soon. And some of the some of these other programs or other even broader policies will take time to get into place, and you know, as some of the CADMUS analyses have shown, and as all of us actually understand well, the state is not right now on the trajectory it needs to be on to meet these very ambitious goals. And so there is, I guess I'll just end on saying, there's some urgency about finding good places to start, good places to raise proceeds that can be deployed in a thoughtful way that can then make other steps easier to take or even just possible to take in future. So I think it's really helpful to think about all of these and think about how do they interrelate to one another, and how can they be, the words that were used earlier is put to the highest and best use. But there's a time frame component to highest and best use as well, is the point I wanted to make. And I'll stop there. But thank you again very much. This has been a really helpful articulation of the conversations that have gone on in recent weeks.
So if I can build on what Paul said, I think it's a thank you to the staff who has been through the very many meetings with the various subcommittees and trying to pour down here what we've had in those discussions. I think you've done a phenomenal job of doing that, and I really appreciate all the artwork that's required and the conversations that we've had. And I think these really do reflect the many conversations out there. I think to Paul's point, we need to do all of the above, right? We need to be putting out those long-term goals and objectives and standards so that the whole industry of the transportation sector starts moving in that direction. But we also have to recognize that even under those best scenarios right now, we're talking about, continuing to have a lot of vehicles on the road that are not going to be electric in the near term. And we're talking, at least a decade before we're looking at 100% sales of zero emission light duty vehicles. We're talking about potentially two decades before we get there on medium and heavy duty vehicles. And we need to be doing all that we can and should be doing to reducing emissions from those sectors in the meanwhile. And I think many of these policies are enabling policies, as you pointed out, to help us achieve those goals and frankly, to accelerate them. So I think that's where a clean fuel standard can and has been making changes to help us move in that direction. You know, I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, California has 1% of their transportation fuel is currently electric, but 20% of their credits goes to the electric sector. So that's something that really can help to accelerate. And in New York, that may be, you know, it'll be a little bit different, but it'll be in that same sort of ballpark. Here it might be better because our grid is cleaner than California's is. So, you know, making sure that we're doing these things that will not only help us meet those goals, but actually push down on those emissions and the other pollutants and have the fossil fuel industry pay for it. So that's where I think a clean fuel standard and TCI both together can help to do both of those things to move us along. I, of course, am a huge fan of congestion pricing. We're very excited to see that start to move forward at the state level. We'd love to see the, or for New York City, we'd love to see that explored further for other areas, and making sure that we're providing these incentives to get people into mass transit and into micromobility and off of the car in the first place. You know, we probably haven't talked as much about some of the benefits here that some of the strategies we've talked about today can help us deal with off-road and things like aviation and shipping that we don't have, you know, as much control over at the state level, but still have significant impacts. And making sure that we're framing all of that in making the investments first and foremost to address, you know, frontline communities that have been subjected to pollution for so long. So I think there are ways of learning from how these other programs have worked elsewhere and make them better and meet our goals.
Thanks, Julie. You know, along the lines of the point that you just made at the end of your comments there with regard to some of the freight and commercial sectors of the economy, that's why we're doing an additional freight panel for this transportation advisory panel, because we need to have that, I think, continued long-term view and take it on as part of our work here. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it as to the freight panel as well, and that's what we teed up at the beginning. You know, it's more of a holistic view of everything. So everything, we wish you could do it all at once, but a number of people have commented on the fact that, you know, taking these in the sequence and understanding how we finance and pay for each of these, that's the genesis of this conversation. Because it's a critical element, and being extremely cognizant of those financing policies and how we advance this level of investment is, I think it's incumbent upon us to be thoughtful about it. All right, any other comments from the panel members?
Yeah, hi, Commissioner, this is Puri.
Hi, Puri.
I just wanted to... I'm having a little difficulty with my video, but I'm going to start talking. I'm following up on Paul, and I was kind of coming to that, and I'm glad Paul brought that up, is as to what we're doing now and what we're going to be, where are we going to go with this, you know, beyond 2050. So we are kind of looking at very focused 2030 goals right now, to all the things. And every presentation so far in all of these panels have been absolutely wonderful, in depth, including today's. What I've talked about often, and I brought it up here and there in between, is that we somehow kind of very quickly go past this whole smart growth strategies. You know, it's sort of not something, it really shouldn't, in my opinion, that we should embrace the smart growth strategies in every one of these discussions that we have and every one of these strategies that get developed. And some of them by the way, some of them do embrace them, even though not in the beginning it ends up becoming that way. But it has to be, I think, going forward beyond 2030 and beyond 2050, it's going to be really very, very important to embrace and incorporate smart growth and land use, because those are the things that eventually, I mean, yes, it's they connect, they depend, it's all, one relies on the other, you know, public transportation, land use, development are so integrated, intermittently related, that we need to kind of keep a focus on that. When we talk about, you know, resiliency, it's not, adaptation and resiliency is just kind of a part of smart growth, emissions and energy uses reduction, whether it's electrification, public transportation, or clean fuel uses, and all of them connected, very, very closely connected to preservation, economic empowerment, and then, of course, all boils down to planning and development, where the land use issues come in. So I think we need to have sort of a much broader umbrella. And I don't mean right now. I mean going forward, because these are wonderful recommendations which are going to get turned into standards, which are going to become sort of a menu, if you will, for municipalities to follow. And so I think all of that, it'd be great to be integrated with a smart growth policy, land use, which is a big part of land use, and the greenhouse gas reduction, climate adaptation and resiliency. And then with that, I just want to, I was just thinking, it's that there has to be some sort of an entity, whether it's statewide or whether it's, centralized or decentralized, is that some entity that is going to be supporting. And And this is not the job right now. I understand that. But I think it has to be remembered that there has to be some entity who's going to hold these municipalities, the smaller ones especially, their hands to say, this is how, you know, what you need to do, you know, almost. And Paul Bayer always talks about this menu and say, okay, you know, pick and choose and get some advice as to how this little town and villages are going to go forward with these recommendations. So I mean, this is not specific to this. My comments are not specific to this presentation, but it is. I think I just came up right. Sorry, I'm here now. That's. I just wanted to bring that up because it's sort of the elephant in the room in a way, and we are working, and we do have to do that on details. But we have to be much cognizant of this whole overview of smart growth and land use issues. So that's my comment. I just wanted to say that.
I greatly appreciate it, Ori. I think that's the challenge, right? That we've got all of this work, and we're trying to pull it all together and tie it together. And you're right, Paul has been repeating that, and I know the work of the subgroup has been integral to helping us do that. So thank you. All right, listen, we only have about 15 minutes left, and so I want to make sure that we get to if you could advance a slide, please, to talk through some of the questions that the advisory panel's members have had with regard to the current programs and incentives that the that are being administered by New York to accelerate the purchase of zero emission vehicles. And so what I'm going to do is ask Adam if he could start to go through this. And I recognize we're short on time, but Adam, if you could, even if we get through a portion of it and we have to pick up later at another meeting, that's fine. But I just want to make sure that we at least start to go through some of these materials, since we have had inquiries from the various panel members. Thank you.
Sure, and I'll go quickly, and we can always dig in more deeply another time. Thanks, Commissioner, and I just wanted to share a little bit of information about current programs. These are potentially models for expanded programs as we move forward, although not necessarily. There are some reasons why we may want to adjust these going forward, especially if we are talking about much broader and more expanded programs. But hopefully this can give people a little sense of how much we've done to date and how much further we have to go. But, we'll dig in. So wanted to first talk about the New York Truck Voucher Incentive Program, which I know we had received some questions about on a previous meeting. As of right now, there's about $54 million available through this program for medium and heavy-duty trucks, buses, and repowers of vehicles. It's funded by a combination of Volkswagen settlement money and money through from U.S. DOT through New York State DOT through the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Program. This functions as a point-of-sale discount, so the money comes directly off the purchase price of the truck, includes involvement of vehicle manufacturers, dealers, and the fleet themselves. There are scrappage requirements to get older diesel vehicles, dirty diesel vehicles, off of the road in almost all cases. Next slide. Here you can just see the breakdown of funding for the different from the different funding sources and vehicle types. Won't spend too much time on this. This is all on our truck program website as well. Next slide. Similarly, you can see the incentive levels for these different types of vehicles. They do vary. This is an up to amount, either a percentage of the incremental cost, the difference in cost between that vehicle and a standard diesel vehicle, up to a certain level based on the vehicle weight class. This ranges up to $385,000 for all electric transit, Class 8 transit buses. Next slide. The Truck Voucher Program has been around since 2014 in one form or another. In the previous iteration from 2014 through 2018, we were able to work with 60 fleets to either convert or retrofit or purchase new vehicles for about 600 vehicles. There was a wide range of technologies available, including diesel emission filters, as well as alternative fuel vehicles. Since we reopened the program in about a year and a half ago, we have been working with 15 fleets that have approved voucher applications for 85 vehicles and about $13 million. A little bit more than half of the vehicles are all electric. The vast majority of the money is for all electric trucks, and there was a little bit of money for CNG and other technologies, but the large majority of the money is for all electric trucks and buses. Next slide. And just to give a little bit more granular breakdown of the types of vehicles that have been participating, a lot of heavy vehicles, a lot of transit buses, but there also have been a lot of delivery trucks, refuse trucks, and other types of vehicles as well. We are seeing mostly larger fleets, but we have seen applications from some small fleets as well, and are really trying to expand the reach to smaller fleets through directed outreach. We've been working with Kendra and the Trucking Association to reach further into the ranks of their membership and working on some targeted outreach to increase participation. Next slide. I also wanted to touch on the Drive Clean Rebate program for electric vehicles. This is for passenger vehicles. This program has been around just about 4 years, and we've provided rebates for over 35,000 electric vehicles across New York State. It's just about 50-50 between all electric and plug-in hybrids. And we have almost gone through the initial allocation of $55 million for the program. Next slide. So for this program, it's also a point of sale rebate. So the money is applied to the vehicle purchase directly. It's a sliding scale, there are different rebate levels based on the range of the electric range of the vehicle. And you can see that the largest portion of rebates so far have gone to all electric vehicles with greater than 120 mile range. And most of those have over 200 mile range. Almost all of them have over 200 mile range. And a little bit more purchases than leases, but it's relatively even there. Next slide. And again, this is the numbers through the end of 2020. You'll note that the biggest month to date for the program was October 2020, and before COVID hit, we had two or three months of more than 1,000 rebates. But after the economy really reopened in June, every month since then has been over 1,000 rebates. So we are seeing some really good uptake, and it's been increasing lately. Next slide. New York State has a number of different charging programs. I know we've heard about the Public Service Commission's Make Ready order from last July, and which directed the six investor-owned utilities to set up programs for installing for supporting the installation of over 50,000 EV charging stations by 2025. Of that $700 million, over $200 million targeting disadvantaged communities, which is a needed investment in EV charging in those areas. NYPA is also making major investments in EV charging through their Evolve New York program, which is focused primarily on fast chargers. NYSERDA offers two programs. We have a Charge Ready New York program, which provides some standard rebates for level two charging stations at public, workplace, and multi-unit dwelling locations. There's about $7 million remaining there. And we have a DC fast charger program that is offering $11 million of VW settlement funds for fast chargers in a number of the upstate regions that really don't have as much current investment in fast chargers as we'd like. Next slide. And just to show from a map perspective, we are actually now over 2,000 charging ports at over 400 locations for the Charge Ready program, really statewide. Obviously, more activity in some of the major urban areas, but we are seeing interest across the state in big cities and small towns. One thing that I am very pleased to have seen is that as the program has progressed, we have seen the average cost of these stations falling and I think it's a trend we'll hopefully see continue. The average cost now sits around $6,500 to $7,000 per port, which fell from about $9,000 when we started the program. And that was my very quick recap. Hopefully we can, I'm happy to dig into any of these more with panel members another time.
Hey,
Hey, Adam, this is Albert. Can I make a quick comment just on the DC Fast Charger program? And thanks for highlighting that. There was a lot of debate, obviously, about that, the design of that program, petitions for rehearing, and a lot of criticism from EV advocates that that the design was not as effective as it could have been. And I bring it up just because one of the primary arguments we're hearing deployed against rate design as a policy to support EV deployment, and we heard some of this in the power generation panel, is that the demand charge issue was addressed by DPS through this program. And from what we can see, after 2 years with a goal of, you know, over 1,000 new plugs, there are only 77 in service or pending as a result of that program. So I think that context would be helpful when advocating for rate design in the full council, and just always good to emphasize that New York is really an outlier in not addressing this problem through rates. Thanks.
Thanks, Albert. And that's a good point. I actually hadn't mentioned the per plug incentives that that you're referring to. That's another initiative that DPS had put in place that's intending to reduce the operating costs for DC fast chargers. Good. Thanks for that additional context.
All right. Any other comments or questions from any of the panel members? I know many of you had some questions in the past, hoping we're addressing some of this information requests. Okay. All right. Hearing none, with a couple minutes that we have remaining, I just want to come, if we can hit the next slide, please. All right. So let's talk about next steps here. So we had a lot of information today, and as I said at the top of the meeting, we want to make sure that we incorporate your comments as we move forward. So we've got an email that's teed up. You all will be receiving it, the Transportation Advisory Panel members, after this meeting. And again, providing you more information, what you saw presented today, and would value your comments, your input, on the materials that we presented, a little bit more time to think about it. But as we move forward, you know, what we're driving towards is obviously the final recommendations, not final recommendations, but the intentional recommendations that we're making to the Climate Action Council. And again, would greatly appreciate your input in all of this. I think the last thing is, you know, we'll be aggregating all of this together and finalizing it. One thing that I want to put on everybody's radar again is that we've got two more advisory panel meetings. So the first one will be, you know, this effort to aggregate all the recommendations and review them again on April the 9th. That'll be from 1 to 3 p.m. And then we're going to be hosting two additional roundtables. The first one will be on equity and public health. That is tentatively scheduled right now for the first week in April, and we'll send out details. And then the second is what I mentioned earlier, an expert panel on freight, which is right now tentatively scheduled for either April the 30th or likely one day the first week in May. So those are the three additional meetings we've got going. Obviously the first on recommendations, and then the other two panel member, rather round tables, one on equity and public health and the other one on freight. So any questions from the panel members? Otherwise, we're at 101. I greatly appreciate everybody's participation again today. Everybody's been working extremely hard in all of these subgroups, and we value what your many contributions, and we'll keep going. We got a lot to do on this. All All right. Without hearing anything, wish you all well. Enjoy your afternoon, and thank you again. Take care.
Commissioner.
Thank you.